You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 489 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the AL West champion Mariners.
There we go. Are we changing that permanently? Or just when we re-sign Josh Naylor?
No, I've been using it. Like, you know, if they're not leading the AL West next year, we'll go back to the four-time WNBA champions.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the number one, still with a bullet, DVOA leaders, Seattle Seahawks.
Had number one in DVOA all the way. It's the Doug Baldwin Jr. edition of the Pelton Cast. But again, we're starting out, unfortunately, by remembering a titanic figure in Seattle sports. In this case, Seahawks legend Kenny Easley, who passed away Saturday at age 66. The UCLA product was the number four pick by the Seahawks in 1981, played all seven of his NFL seasons in Seattle before being forced to retire by a kidney disease discovered during the physical he took with the Phoenix Cardinals after being traded for Kelly Stauffer. Easley was the NFL Defensive Player of the Year in 1984 when he led the NFL with 10 interceptions, returned two of them for touchdowns. Is part of a Seahawks defense that led the league with 38 picks as a team. A five-time Pro Bowler, three-time All-Pro pick, who was a part of the 1980s All-Decade team. Easley was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2017, has been a part of the Seahawks Ring of Honor since 2002. But I would say that his legacy goes well beyond, you know, his role on the football field. He was part of a generation of NFL players that began kind of pushing back against the league and the cultures and norms that existed there for a long period of the time. He sued the Seahawks after his kidney disease diagnosis, attributing it to taking unsafe quantities of Advil to deal with an ankle injury before settling out of court in 1990, and believed the Seahawks traded him in large part because of his work with the NFLPA during the 1987 NFL strike. After understandably holding a grudge against the organization for a long period of time, Easley reconciled with the Seahawks after the team sailed to Paul Allen in time to go into the Ring of Honor, and later served as an honorary captain for the Seahawks at Super Bowl 49. So Kenny Easley, you know, we are too young to remember Kenny Easley as a player or, you know, to have been following the Seahawks at that time, but someone who, you know, is such an important part of the franchise's history in his legacy that, you know, it was impossible not to feel a connection to him and be glad that he was reconnected to the organization before he passed away. All right, well, following up on the story from last week, congrats to UW Women's Soccer, which beat Montana 2-0 on Friday to advance in the NCAA tournament for the second consecutive year. Both of those goals came from Alex Buck, who scored early in the 11th minute and late in the 90th to see things out. Huskies now move on to face number 4 seed Arkansas Thursday in Charlottesville, Virginia at 12 noon Pacific time. It'll be broadcast on ESPN+. Also moving on to the NCAA tournament, congrats to UW Men's Soccer, chosen as an at-large after finishing second in the Big Ten at 10-6-2 overall. They'll face the Oregon State Beavers in Corvallis on Thursday at 6 p.m. in the opening round. Also on ESPN+, that's a rematch of a regular season matchup, a non-conference matchup, where Oregon State beat the Huskies 2-1 in August in Corvallis. Probably very similar weather to what we'll see on Thursday. All right, and lastly this week, congrats to Big Ten Player of the Week, Xavier Sellers. Sellers had 30 points Saturday as the Huskies won at Utah without leading scorer El Ladin to continue their unbeaten and ranked start. We can sort of switch from the toasts into the Mariners because this falls into both. As we got the news on Sunday, after the Seahawks lost to the Rams, when we needed a pick-me-up, that the Seattle Mariners had re-signed first baseman Josh Naylor to a five-year contract. We learned subsequently is worth $92.5 million, includes a full no-trade clause for Naylor. And this was interesting. So Jeff Passan had his offseason preview on Tuesday. The Mariners so proactive re-signing Josh Naylor that they did it before Jeff Passan could even preview the offseason. Reported that the Pirates were another suitor for Josh Naylor and had offered at least double their largest free agent contract ever, which was $39 million for Francisco Liriano. But knew all along the Mariners, you know, had made it clear that re-signing Naylor was their top priority after how well he fit after the trade deadline last year. And without dragging this out whatsoever, as MLB free agency so often does, they get it done and bring Nails back for the long term. This is usually where you react to the news.
It was great. It was great and it was expected. I honestly didn't doubt for a second about whether Josh Naylor would be back with the Mariners. I saw, you know, like you scroll through various predictions where players are going to go or whatever for the offseason. And every time I would see Naylor, what's the word, connected to another team in some prediction, I was just like, not a chance. Gino, sure, maybe. Other players, maybe. Josh Naylor was going to be a Mariner. It was done. You know, like they had already started those conversations. Jerry had made it a priority. Naylor wanted to be here. It just made sense. It was one of those marriages that he got to Seattle and it clicked right away for him and the city of Seattle and this team. And they made sure to get it done. And I do think, I honestly, this doesn't tell me necessarily anything about the Mariners being different or whatever. It was a good deal. It made sense. I thought they got him a pretty good number for where Josh Naylor could be. It was right about, like, it wasn't too much money. It wasn't too low. It was perfect. It was perfect across the board. Also, I think the thing that's interesting about Josh Naylor is that when you look at MLB free agents, he's on the quite a bit younger side of those types of players who hit free agency. You know, if you were to look at like the top 50 free agents this year, being at 28, Josh Naylor on a 5-year deal, it's not like you're signing him for year 33 through 38, which wouldn't, you know, like it would be riskier at that point for that 5-year deal. But Josh Naylor's not going to be that old by the end of this deal.
No. Yeah, it takes him through his early 30s. And it'll be interesting to see how Naylor ages. He doesn't have a lot of speed to lose, is the nice thing. But, you know, his base running obviously was such an important thing for the Mariners. Just fit well into the clubhouse, beloved by the fans, embraced the city, as you said. You know, it was an A-plus fit. And to your point, David Schoenfield, writing about this in his free agency grade, my colleague at ESPN.com, said that it was the most obvious move on the board in free agency, Naylor returning to the Mariners. And a stat from him in grading that in A-minus, which I'm not familiar with that grade. I didn't know that was a possible thing.
Was this a B-plus for you, the signing?
A clear B-plus. A thorough B+. Mariners first baseman had the second lowest on OPS since 2005, ahead of only the Pittsburgh Pirates. So this has been a trouble spot for the Mariners for a long period of time. And now it's one that they can feel good about for the next few years here with Naylor signed up.
Yeah, I'm feeling great about it. It was awesome to be. I was driving through the city yesterday on I-5, and right there in T-Mobile Park is like a kind of strange font, big JN. Yeah.
It's very odd. At first, I was like, "Wait, is?" I thought that said "in" when I first read it, and then I got it.
I was driving there with Illuminati Hotties. Their guitarist's name is Jake Novak, and he is. I was like, "They've got your initials right there on the stadium for you, Jake."
That's how excited.
He's the biggest baseball fan too. And I was like, "If you want to realize how excited we are in Seattle about Josh Naylor, we have his motherfucking initials up there. They've never done that for anybody, as
they
far
flew
as I
the
know."
W with Josh Naylor.
That was like literally the first time. I didn't even know that was a mechanism they were capable of.
They didn't do it when they extended Cal Raleigh.
No, definitely not.
Or Julio, which is long ago, might have even been before they flew the W, is a thing.
So people were very, very excited about the Josh Naylor signing.
John Heyman has the contract structure here. It's a $6.5 million signing bonus and then a $10 million salary in 2026. So he'll get $16.5 million in total over the next 12 months. Then $16 million in 27, $18 million in 28, $20 million in 29, $22 million in 2030. And, you know, that's relevant because the Mariners, we estimated somewhere between 30 to 35 million to add to their payroll this offseason. This takes up approximately half of it, but still leaves plenty to bring back Jorge Polanco and maybe address the bullpen if you're assuming that Eugenio Suarez is not in the Mariners' future plans.
I don't think that the roster is going to look particularly different in 2026 than it did in 2025.
And why should?
I will say, going into the season, because the thing that we know about baseball is things change very, very quickly. But this deal doesn't tie them up for too much money long term. Like if Naylor has a down season or he's injured or whatever, knock on wood, at some point in that 5 years, he's not going to perform at an extraordinarily high level. Like that is fine because it's not so money that it's going to so much money that it's going to be crippling for the organization. And the reality is the thing that we talked about for so many years was the Mariners just needed more Major League Baseball players. And now they kind of have a lot of Major League Baseball players, especially on the hitting side. There are players who are capable of being in the majors, who are in the minors. You know, Ben Williamson is a capable Major League Baseball player who is in the minors for them during the playoff run. So it is getting quite a bit deeper, and there are a lot of players pushing them from the minors as well. And so they can use that if it is something where they have to go make a move during the season next year, or if things are just good, then ride it, keep the roster as good as you can and, you know, supplement with those prospects. But they have more flexibility than almost anybody in the league because of the combination of major league talent that they're bringing back with Josh Naylor and because of the minor league talent. Like this team is, they are positioned. It's a baseball, shit can change year to year very, very quickly, but they are positioned probably about as good as you could be for a team with the Mariners, I guess, payroll, if you're not the Dodgers, basically.
Well, I think this was before the Naylor signing was announced. I can't remember what the timing was, but Fangraphs had a social media post of ranking projected WAR for 2026. Now, I guess this would have been after the Naylor sign, so maybe he's incorporated. And obviously before teams add anyone in free agency or via trade. But number one was the Dodgers at 49.5 WAR. Number two was the Yankees at 44.6. Mariners checking in third at 44.4.
Right. Yeah, if you're right behind the Dodgers and the Yankees, that is the best place to be.
So, yeah, I mean, in basically tied with the Yankees for the most of anyone in the AL. They have continued to address the bullpen with some additions of minor leaguers via trade. Alex Hoppe coming over from the Red Sox on Monday in a move that seemed to beat the 40-man roster deadline in the Rule 5 draft, the potential that he was going to get be available in the Rule 5 draft, and then left-handed pitcher Robinson Ortiz coming over from the Dodgers. So this is a thing the Mariners, you know, they like to identify young relievers, and they're not all going to work out, but if a couple of those guys hit, it gives you a lot more depth because what you talked about, this roster is going to change over the course of the season. A lot of people are going to come in and out of the bullpen.
Oh, yeah. And the bullpen is the one position where it's a volume position. And if you find guys, great. And if people don't work out, whatever, you can move on very, very quickly. It is a low-cost volume position. And you don't want to be spending high-value prospects on the position when you get to June and July. It's something that the time to address your bullpen is pretty much right now. To just go get a bunch of arms and hope that a handful of them work out. Because they have arms already, you know, and especially they have a lot of the higher leverage ones, but they just need to go find one or two more.
Yeah. Now, one of those players they are moving from, at least in terms of the 40-man roster, Taylor Salcedo got designated for assignment in that move. So we'll see if he comes back as a non-roster invitee to spring training. Certainly someone who loves the Mariners. By the way, I like that we are both wearing Mariners hoodies as we record this pod in November. The hot stove leg, it is real. One more note from that Jeff Passan offseason preview. Didn't talk a lot about the Mariners, but reported they, quote, have the players but not the desire to land Tarek Skubal via trade.
So, what does that mean?
I think that means that they're not willing to, whatever price it is going to take to convince the Tigers to actually make that deal, this deal, this offseason, which they may not, the Mariners aren't willing to pay that price at a position where they are deep.
The trade that was proposed by Seattle Times, I'm like, no fucking way, right? Like, the Tigers need to be very incentivized. To me, the chances of Skubal getting traded this offseason are extraordinarily low right now. I think the Tigers are planning on going into next year with Skubal on their staff.
I mean, they did make the playoffs. Fun fact about the Tigers.
They're a good team, and Skubal was a starting pitcher in his prime. Like, it is going to take a haul more than what the Seattle Times proposed. Sorry. Like, I mean, sure, yes, the Mariners have the ability to find a package because, I mean, not every team has that ability. The Mariners, with their
No, not every team does have that ability, but the Mariners have the combination of they could send back a quality starter in return and have a number of high value prospects. Like that,
The
like
thing
if
about
someone comes gets traded or like comes on the market like this, the Mariners are always going to be in that discussion of like who could trade for this player because of that
the
scenario.
thing about the like don't have the desire is a strange way to frame it, because do the Mariners have the desire to have Tarek Skubal on their roster?
Of
Yes.
course. Do they
It's
have
that
but do they have the desire to trade what it would take? No.
exactly. That's what, like, so that framing is basically like, I mean, sure, they probably have the desire to trade for Tarek Skubal for some amount of what it would take also. But when it comes down to trading with the team that just knocked you out of the playoffs in your league, and when you're planning on going into the next season as a contender, by all intents and purposes, the Tigers are, like, it would take such an incredible haul. To me, any Skubal conversation is like, I'm sick of hearing about it. Call me if it happens.
Oh, are we putting a moratorium on school
Moratorium on
discussions?
Skubal. Done. It is done.
Do I need to add moratorium to the PeltonCast glossary, or is that
I wish
self-evident
there
enough?
was a moratorium on coaching and a college football coaching carousel conversation, because you were like, this would be a moment where you would jump in earlier, and I'm just searching for Jed Fish on Twitter. So I spent way too much of my day just searching for Bob Chesney places. Like, I don't know, it's unhealthy.
Maybe
It
I
is
need what
unhealthy.
we need in the note, the glossary is a list of PeltonCast
Moratoriums, yeah.
maybe
Moratoriums for the week. Tarek
when they're
Skubal,
lifted.
give me a moratorium on Tarek Skubal conversation.
Okay, you've got an official PeltonCast
There we go.
moratorium.
Can either of us issue a moratorium? Like, does the other one
And
have to
you does
approve
he? Yeah,
it?
I think it's got to be. I think you need unanimous support for the
Okay.
moratorium.
So you're in
Although,
agreement with my Skubal moratorium?
yeah, no, I think it makes sense. We had the conversation. It's been had.
I
We
think
can
it
move
makes
on with
sense.
our lives.
Great.
It would be great if Tarek Skubal pitched for the Mariners. He's probably not going to.
A
There. End of
moratorium
story.
on the letters consecutive UCLA.
Oh,
Until later,
no.
when we preview that game in
I was going to say, yeah.
the
We'll have plenty to say about UCLA later on. Don't you worry.
should we do this slight emergency pod style with
Seahawks
where
Rams?
we yeah we talk about the weekend and then.
I mean, yes, we can go into why we needed a pick me up on Sunday evening, early evening or late afternoon, whenever the Nails news broke.
We could go into maybe why you needed to pick me up.
Oh, wow, because you were that fired up about the Seahawks playing their defense and what they saw. It showed at SoFi Stadium.
I left this game, and this is the way I felt about every single. Okay, I was furious after week one. I don't want to say every game. Do you remember how mad I was at Clint Kubiak after week one?
I do.
Really, to me, the winner of the game is Greg Olsen. Good God, I love hearing Greg Olsen talk about football.
You know what? I kind of dislike it because it's like Greg Olsen is so good at the nerd stuff. He's not leaving anything for us. Like, we need something to rally against, you know?
He said exactly what I said last week on the podcast, where I was like,
I don't remember him saying the Seahawks have the map chef advantage and are surely going to win this game.
I mean, they outplayed the Rams in every capacity of the game, so
We'll talk about it, but I don't remember him saying it. Which part of it did he say?
no, the thing that he said though was when he was talking about why teams don't do what the Rams did, which was leaving the, like, not going heavy in the box and making you pass against them. And
Yes.
he was like, NFL coaches, it's an ego thing. And I was trying to explain that, and I was like, coaches are dumb. Like, that's it's like
That's
dumb is
not
not
the
the right way
same.
to put it.
But we've had this conversation for a long period of time. I vividly recall on this podcast eloquently describing where I understood the way that coaches feel about this because I watched Michigan run all over UW in
It is
2021
so
at
funny to me
Michigan
though
Stadium.
that, like, literally the exact, like, a 10-yard pass could happen and a 10-yard run could happen, and a coach would be furious about the 10-yard run and be like, well, 10-yard pass, we did our best. It is
I mean, I
wild
don't
to
know if I
me.
specifically referenced this last week. We did talk last week about, you know, relative to averages. I mean, the other thing I think about a lot of the time is like the Seahawks defense was another great example of this week. Like the Rams did run all over them in the first quarter in a surprising way, given how well the Seahawks have defended the run this season, and in a way that did help the Rams open up the lead they enjoyed in this game. And then they didn't do jack shit on the ground for the next three quarters. Because it's easy to adjust to runs in a way that is not easy to adjust for passes, unless perhaps you're the Los Angeles Rams.
Okay.
Or I guess the Seahawks, if you're
A
saying that.
moratorium that I want to have,
Oh,
though,
no.
in this is a moratorium on complaining about Sam Darnold. And that is the thing that drove me crazy after this game.
I don't
People
think
being
we
like,
do need a
there was
moratorium
so
about
much
that.
of a gotcha about Sam Darnold in this game from people from all walks of the football life talking about. And I'm like, he is still fourth in total QBR. And the thing that you would basically say, right, is you have to view stuff in a complete picture. You don't just cherry pick stats. You don't just say, well, if you take that thing out, because that thing happened. And if we want to view Sam Darnold as his complete season, he's the fourth best quarterback in the league. By some metrics, he's even better by other metrics.
I mean,
But
I wouldn't put that definitive a number on it, but he has been one of the top five quarterbacks in the NFL. Yes, I would agree.
in EPA plus CPOE, he's still number two after Drake May, which I think is where he was at beforehand. The thing that people have a hard time understanding, this is the annoying thing about like when the Huskies lose to Wisconsin, you don't become a radically different team or something when that happens. It's not like their FPI changed that radically in that game. And when there's a thing about like
Save
what
it for the men's basketball discussion.
DVOA would look like, well, that team fucking sucks. But like when you look at the close games are bad, let me just say. But like when you look at the DVOA discussion, of course they were going to change the DVOA in this.
I mean, I picked second in the poll that we had on the Discord where
Is it
we
because
did
you
finish
like
because
to be wrong about things or?
I think I underestimated the degree to which, when you take away the big plays that the Rams enjoyed in this, which typically are not heavily weighted in DVOA because they don't tend to be as predictive as the play-to-play success rate that the Seahawks would show as having outplayed them. That's what I didn't expect. I thought it was going to be close, but that the Rams were already pretty close in DVOA and would go up to number one.
The other thing that you bring up a lot is when you're starting, right? Like people talk about like wash LeBron, right? And LeBron has so much room from where he was at. This is not like wash Saquon, who can go from being one of the best running backs to literally bad in a year, right? It's so fun calling him wash Saquon, right? Or like Ashton JT. But like when you're talking about where Sam Darnold was versus where he is at now, when you're playing at the ability of the best or maybe the second best quarterback in the NFL, which again, number two in PFF, number four in QBR, number two in EPA plus CPOE. So, like, I don't know what the metric is that you could find that is saying that Sam Darnold after this game, because this is with all the data that has his bad game against the Rams. Sam Darnold is still who we thought he was, which is one of the five best quarterbacks in the league. And I will also say,
Sam Darnold has performed as one of the five best quarterbacks in the league. That's not necessarily the same as being one of the five best quarterbacks in the league.
okay, that's like a splitting hairs thing though. Like,
No, it's not. It's the same as Wisconsin's FPI is much higher than its FPI efficiency. And while we talk about both of those things, there's a reason that you keep that, initial prior in there because sometimes it explains why they end up beating UW that in the snow.
okay. In 2013, the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. You remember that?
I do. I was going to
How
say I
many
was there,
times?
but I wasn't there. I wasn't in East Rutherford or
I was more
the
there than you
Meadowlands.
were. How many times do you think Russell Wilson had a worse QBR in a game that season? It's not actually as many as you're going to guess, but like had a worse QBR in a game than Sam Darnold had on Sunday, where he threw four interceptions
Was
against the LA Rams.
the Rams game on Monday night that season or the following
That
season?
was the previous year.
The previous year.
Or no, maybe that was the next year. The Golden Tate game where he scored that touchdown. Was that 2014?
But I bet there was a home game against the Cardinals. I would
At
say
St. Louis.
three.
Wait, what year was that game?
All right, hold on. Let me look
That might have
this
been
up.
2015. Hold on. I've got his game log right
No,
here.
there's no way it was 2015. I don't think, was Golden Tate even still on the team in 2015?
Oh, I guess it was that year. No, they don't have a QBR listed on ESPN, which is incredible for that one. It is just a dash. So maybe it was
Wow, is
zero.
that bad?
Okay. That's why it didn't stand out to me. For some reason, there's no QBR.
I mean,
I actually don't
he did
know if his
not
QBR
throw.
would have been that
Yeah,
bad.
he didn't throw an interception. So he just didn't really have turnovers, but he was 10 of
Okay.
18 for
But there
139
there were
yards.
two times that season that Russell Wilson was worse in games when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl
Of course.
than Sam Darnold has been this year. That was the Cardinals game, which you remember, one of the worst games I've ever been to. in the second to last week, losing 27-11. Just a miserable fucking game. You dropped me off down there, if you remember that one. There was also that game at Houston. Do you remember when we talked about this? The game at Houston.
I don't know what you're looking at. My stats said they lost 17-10.
Oh, that was his completions attempt. Sorry, they lost 17-10. I was looking at his attempts and completions. That's how bad they were in that game. That it was a bad blowout. I thought it was reasonable that that was the score.
The Carolina game, he wasn't bad. What was the other game where he was very bad?
It was at Houston. I think it was the game
The Matt Schaub game. Yeah.
Yeah. Richard Sherman had a pick six on a play that was like the first week that we did the Pelton cast was that game. But then also two other times that year,
true. We did the Pelton cast the previous week.
There were two other times that year that he was in the 30s, right? At the game at San Francisco that they won 29-3. This is not his rookie year. This is his second year. Was in the 30s in that game, 142 yards on a 42% completion percentage. The Super Bowl winning quarterback, Russell Wilson. And then same for the St. Louis game that they ended up clinching the number one seed at the end of the year. You have bad games sometimes. And I'm willing to accept that Sam Darnold, I think it's almost been, the stats say that it was a bad game. I think it's been a little bit exaggerated how bad of a game it was. And the thing about interceptions is, he didn't throw that many more interceptable passes than the four that were intercepted. But there were some balls that he missed where I was like, Sam Darnold normally hits that. The Rams played good defense in this game. Sam Darnold wasn't sharp. And to me, it is like, I just can't wait to get this team at home. Because the defense, what they did to Matt Stafford, he's still Matt, thank you. After that performance, he's Matt. But like, what they did to Matt Stafford and Sean McVay's offense, woke Sean McVay, but like the new era evolved Sean McVay. What they did to that team was impressive in the second half. And this was a game that the Seahawks lost 21-19. Sam Darnold threw four interceptions in the game. The Rams only had one turnover and they lost it on a last second field goal. And I will recall for you, the real reason they lost this game was not because in the end, right, Rams played fine, whatever. It was a close game statistically. The punt that happened, we were talking like, I don't know what the odds are if you're where you were to have the ball end up at the 1 yard line, but we were talking about 3 feet away from the Seahawks probably winning the game. If that ball comes out to the 25, and the Seahawks start there, they're winning this game. We know it. So it was, I mean, just having to make up for all of those yards. The fact that they could have won this game and how the defense played, and even the drive that Darnold had beforehand, like the way that they just kept going and a little bit of his bad luck. There was the holding that negated the Ken Walker touchdown. There was the throw that like the ball that got tipped on, I think it was Rashid Shaheed who was going up for a touchdown that gets tipped away at the last second. Like, there were a couple of small moments where, and Darnold had some balls perfectly there. It feels like one of those games that the Seahawks had so many different avenues to victory, and the Rams had that one. The Rams had that avenue that they got to victory, and the Seahawks could have won that game a lot of different ways. And that, to me, means when they come here, like, talent-wise, if you want to talk about the Sam Darnold, like, true talent or whatever, where they're playing, this Seahawks team is a better team than that Rams team. They didn't win the game, but they are a better team overall than the Rams are. DVOA tells us that, right? The stats tell us that, and ultimately the outcome with interceptions again, tell us that.
You seem to conveniently ignore that not always is like what has happened the best predictor of what will happen. You have to include a degree
they are better also by the thing that what has happened, they're better by DVOA, which is predictive.
No, the predictive version is Dave. And the Seahawks are in fact better by a whole whopping 1%.
1% better.
I mean, it's functionally meaningless. These two teams should be treated as of identical ability going forward. And they should be treated as
the number one and number two teams in the NFL.
Agreed.
It's just the annoying thing is this always happens to us. It's fun. I will say it is fun, but it is very annoying that every time the Seahawks get really good, there's always another team in the NFC West who is also really good.
It is bizarre. Like, if you looked at the years where the Seahawks had the best record and like how good were the other, was the second best team or the other best team in the NFC West. And like, there's no one else that this could possibly happen to, that there's always another good team. Like, I guess the Seahawks, what they really are doing is karmically making up for the period in the early 2000s where the NFC West was so atrocious and those homegrown teams regularly won the NFC West by default. And in 2010, when they were not good but managed to win the division and set up a memory that we will talk about later in this very podcast, I can guarantee it. Anyways, I think you made an important point. Like, Sam Darnold's process wasn't good on those interceptions. All of those passes deserve to be intercepted, but a lot of passes that deserve to be intercepted aren't. And the odds that the Rams are going to catch all four of those passes are actually not that high, frankly. Ben Baldwin pointed this out on social media in his weekly thread that in terms of turnover-worthy plays as measured by PFF, Darnold is still above average, even though he's trending closer to average. So despite all the interceptions he's thrown, like other quarterbacks have on a rate basis, made more turnover-worthy plays, and just not all of them have turned into turnovers. So he has been a little bit unfortunate in that regard. I mean, I think one of the things that happened is because of the fact that, you know, the narrative so obviously was trending, the dialogue, let's say, was obviously trending a certain way, the Seahawks players coming to Sam Darnold's defense actually meant that locally.
I love that shit, though. I was really hyped on that.
I loved it, too. I mean, Ernest Jones was wrong.
What did he say?
The defense did its job.
Oh, he said we didn't do our job?
he said like we could have made more plays, it's true. One of the things that, like, it's not the defense's fault they allowed the Rams to score when the Rams got the ball at the five, but a key play in the game was they scored on fourth and goal from the two on that second drive. And if they don't, don't score on that play.
Yeah, going into that, I was like, wow, the Seahawks are going to do this back. Like, that is going to be crushing.
The entire flow of the game is different. But I also think the entire flow of the game is different if the Rams aren't leading by the margin that they are for much of this game and really throttle back on offense.
What is the thing, though? What does that mean practically? Because Matt Stafford wasn't like...
We talked about that they have passed the ball enormous amount relative to past seasons.
They still passed the ball quite a bit in this game, though. I don't think that the Rams were like just running the ball into the line three times. I mean, we could look at this series by series. The Rams were trying to go and win that game. They just couldn't do it. Like,
I mean,
Matt Stafford threw the ball 28 times for 130 yards.
On early downs, they were 50-50 run and pass. Now, I do think, like, look, both of these teams know what the other, like, Craig Olsen set it up perfectly. We didn't know quite what to make of Mike McDonald's answer because it was a little wishy-washy and I wouldn't want him to give away the strategy anyway. But they did the thing that Craig Olsen talked about. Neither of these teams worried about giving up the run. They worried about defending the pass and then still defended the run pretty well and very well in both cases. I mean, that's the real story of this game, is that the Rams dared the Seahawks to run and they were not good enough to run. That to me is it. And then there's this weird talk post-game about like, Mike McDonald saying Ken Walker's earned more attempts. He had negative 0.14 EPA per play. Charbonnet had minus 0.17. He had like the one explosive run and still averaged around 4 yards per carry. Maybe there's
PFF
something on the tape.
PFF loves what Ken Walker is doing, for what it's worth.
I'm not a tape guy.
I didn't think Geno Smith
was going to be an MVP candidate this year. The results are not there to support the feelings about Ken Walker III's superiority in the run game.
I mean, I think that the number one thing that the Seahawks are going to have to figure out going forward is they just have to get a little bit better at running the ball.
Yeah.
Like, they have to get better at, and I don't think it's a thing that can't happen. Like, I think it is a thing that probably will happen by the end of the season.
I don't think it probably will. I disagree. And one of the hopes you had is that, you know, they cited Oluwatimi coming in at center as part of the reason they ran the ball better in the second half. The week before against the Cardinals, and that did not necessarily carry over. And I do think the interior rush, particularly after Gray Zabel went out of the game very late, like, became a real issue, because if you want to talk about, you know, the Rams own Sam Darnold, like, the thing that Sam Darnold continues to struggle with is interior pass rush, and the Rams are very good at that. And then the other thing about it is they have the defenders to on the in the secondary to, play aggressively and not, leave opportunities for the Seahawks. So I think both of these defenses are very
Gray
good. And
Zabel is not a good run blocker. Like, I think people are a little confused on Gray Zabel, but there's almost nothing that suggests that Gray
I'm not
Zabel is.
citing him because they didn't run the ball very much on the final. I mean, on
You're
the final
talking about the
drive, the
pass
pass
blocking.
protection
I mean, I think
became an issue.
he's up to fine. I think we've sort
I
of.
think the idea is that Oluwatimi is a slightly better run blocker, but a weaker pass blocker than
The.
Sendell.
I mean, I'm gonna. I felt like Ken Walker, he doesn't have a lot of holes to run through, and he's
Not, I
done a
mean, the
better
list of.
job of getting yardage than he has in the past.
I agree
I
with
think Ken
that.
Walker is doing a better job. He's doing a better job of not doing the annoying Ken Walker things.
I think they're playing him the appropriate amount, and it's fine.
I am not a Gray Zabel guy, but like I do think consistency on the offensive line is important. The reason that this has been working, I do think, is like a little bit in spite of the offensive line still.
Also, they just ran Brock Corum a lot, and it was not
Blake Corum,
working.
still Blake Corum.
I'm just always going to look at that and see Brock.
Just because they ran Blake Corum a lot doesn't mean that they're throttling it back. They weren't saving Kyron Williams for something.
I mean, the relative, obviously they've used Blake Corum a fair amount all season, but the relative distribution here was not that much Kyron Williams. I mean, obviously the final, they just didn't run very many plays because of the fact that they kept getting interceptions and the Seahawks were having these extraordinarily long drives because of the way that the Rams were playing defense.
So, do you think that Matt Stafford wasn't trying to throw the ball in these passes for more yards?
No,
Like,
I'm
what?
saying that I do think there's an element where is we've seen oftentimes since you just cited this with Russell Wilson, how Russell Wilson could have these bad games and then still have very good games and lead the team to a Super Bowl. Part of what happened is sometimes you have a series of short drives, you're out of rhythm all game, and that I think happened to the Rams in this game. So obviously the Seahawks have a very good defense, but I do think that when these two teams play each other, both offenses in Seattle are going to be much more effective depending on what the weather is.
I am fascinated to see it, but I do think of the Seahawks, and I don't how they've been good in the red zone for the 2025 season in general, right?
I don't know. That's not one of the things I have a strong handle on.
It has seemed from memory like they've been. This is actually not very Pete Carroll game, by the way. They had the ball 38 minutes in this one. They kind of
No.
dominated time of possession. Also,
Very
just all
un-Pete
the
Carroll.
turnovers, Pete Carroll would like Drew Locke would have been playing, but like the.
Oh, Pete Carroll's a. This version of Pete Carroll's okay with turnovers, apparently.
Six carries for 7 yards for a top five pick. Two thumbs
Buddy.
up. Two thumbs up.
Love to have Pete Carroll in the league and not coaching my team.
I wish we got to play him. I think it was kind of randomness that they didn't score touchdowns in this. I don't
Look,
know
red
if
zone
I'm.
is always going to be largely a product of randomness. I do think they're, to the extent that like you're trying to give the Seahawks the run, well, you don't have to have that same degree of trade-off. You don't have to worry about taking away explosive plays when you're in the red zone. So that probably is an advantage for the Rams defense in that situation. But as you say, the Seahawks offense has generally been pretty good in the red zone. I'm not super concerned about it. And like,
I'm trying to
look,
see. Yeah,
even if
last
Sam
drive.
Darnold isn't very good in big games, guess what? The Seahawks didn't play any fucking big games before. What was the biggest game they played in recent memory before this? It was probably Thanksgiving against the 49ers at home, which, by the way, you cited the Mike McDonald DVOA Bowl as having been on Thanksgiving. It was actually Christmas because the 49ers were busy playing the Seahawks on Thanksgiving.
Was Christmas night. It was great. I mean, they got to the 3 yard line on the drive right before the half. You know, it's not like they weren't close to the end zone. And I do think those things, like if the Seahawks score a touchdown on one of those 3 drives, the whole game probably looks different overall. And it managed to. So that's where I'm kind of like, I don't think you can just say that the Rams throttled it back so their stats aren't good, because the Seahawks also had moments where it was like, had this happened, then the game looks different.
Well, that's what I'm
Also,
saying
I
is
think we settled into.
the offenses are both offenses are going to be better. I think the Seahawks have probably like a 55% chance of winning
Oh, it's
when they play
100%.
in Seattle.
The health, assuming health, but
100% of the time, it works every time.
the receivers for the Rams did not have separation in this game and how fast that Seahawks defense looks is, it is obscene. I left that just being like, good God, this defense with Reek, the way that Reek is playing, like even the touchdown that Devontae Adams scored was not, it was the most Rams. I was thinking of Kevin playing Devontae Adams in fantasy, but like that touchdown, like Reek was right there. There were so many plays where Nicky Manwari. Also, can we just that hit the penalty that Devin Witherspoon had on the first series? I know it didn't lead to points, but it did lead to the field position changing after that. That was one of the worst calls that I've ever seen.
It was truly inexplicable.
But I left this game again, just being like, I feel the same way that I felt in 2012, which is, we know what is going on. The rest of the league hasn't quite caught up. I don't think people are over. We're DVOA wise. Why do you have this for defensive DVOA? Where are the Seahawks at?
Number one.
Okay. I will tell you the story around the league. It is not about the Seahawks defense. The story around the league is about the Philadelphia Eagles, and the Seahawks are better than the Eagles, and the Seahawks are better than the Chiefs, and they're better than the Broncos, and they're better than the Colts, and they're better than any of these teams in the NFC, than the bad Vikings, and the why are they here Bears, and all of these teams. It is the Seahawks and the Rams. That is it. That's what the Super Bowl is going to come down to, is those two teams. I hope they play each other in the playoffs, because it'll be very, very, very likely fun. Will. And honestly, if it happens at SoFi again, there will be a lot of Seahawks fans in the building.
So, whose house?
There were a lot of Seahawks fans in the building on Sunday, but for a playoff game, it will be very heavy. So there aren't, I think going at Philadelphia is hard. I think going at Green Bay is hard. Beyond that, there's not a lot that scares me across the NFC. So I think the Seahawks are in a great place. They have to go just do what they have to do against some of these other teams, and it's going to set up this showdown against the Rams.
Well, I think they're going to do what they have to do this weekend, but we'll talk about that.
But I do think you're right, which is the Seahawks are playing in big games, and that was the biggest game. I mean, there were a lot of big games across the league last week, but it was probably the biggest one, and they have more of them coming up, right? Like they have, well, I don't know. We'll see. Minnesota, they have the Atlanta. They have the Colts. They have they in a 4-day the window. Here. They have other big games. But to be able to have those moments this year, and the Bucks game was a big game. They are playing in big games.
Niners looked kind of mean.
Did they? Their offense, maybe their defense is fucking terrible. Do you know what Jacoby Brissett went in that game?
I do know, because I was going against him in fantasy.
Okay. They only gave up 22 points, and I think the Cardinals fumbled at the goal line, but like...
Oh, I didn't realize they had three turnovers, and that's why I that was another, that was one I was obviously not paying a lot of attention to, but...
Let me give you a... And granted, you know, like, if you want to talk about game
flow-wise... Throttling it down?
6.9 yards per play for the Cardinals.
Weirdly, also a 13-carry to 8-carry split between their starting running back and their backup running back, and Brian Robinson Jr. was more effective than... Blake Corum, but Christian McCaffrey also considerably more effective than Kyren Williams and got just 13 carries.
What about those 15 catches for 185 yards for Michael Wilson were mean by the 49ers?
Wow. Isn't that just Mr. Smith anymore?
That's a fantasy performance by Michael Wilson.
Maybe should pick him up.
Anyway, have you been sufficiently proven wrong about the 49ers?
I mean, still think their offense is good with Brock Purdy. I'm standing by that take.
I thought their offense was good with Mac Jones, but if you can't play defense, not that it wasn't, doesn't matter. No,
okay.
I don't think their offense is good enough that I'm not going to assume they're going to lose one of hosting Carolina or going at Cleveland.
Hold on. Arizona had 17 penalties in this game, and San Francisco had one? How was I not aware of that beforehand? What on earth? Who was doing the game? Joey Bosa? All right. Well, let's do the roundup. We'll get back to the Seahawks at the end and preview their
matchup.
We're
not going to talk Huskies really quick.
I don't think we need to recap last week. We can talk about that in the UW section. All right, let's start with the Kraken, who won twice at home last week before starting a four-game road trip Tuesday in Detroit with a 4-2 loss to the Red Wings. This trip will take them through the Midwest before finishing in New York against the Islanders. In time for that game Tuesday, the Kraken activated goaltender Joey Decord off IR, but lost backup goalie Matt Murray to a lower body injury that is expected to sideline him for 6 weeks, meaning their three netminder experiment will not continue for the time being. All right, Sounders news. Changes are afoot in MLS. The Board of Governors voted last week in favor of switching to a traditional FIFA calendar in 2027,
Hello.
With the season starting in the middle of July and running through spring playoffs in a May MLS Cup. The league will take a winter break, reportedly likely from the second week of December through sometime in February. The Athletic had that one. And MLS also moving for 2027 away from conferences to a single table with the playoff
Wow.
format TBD, but one possibility being 5-6-5 team divisions or 5-6 team divisions, one or the other.
Why? What?
I guess to
just
reduce
for scheduling.
Travel.
Okay. This is evolved MLS. Is it? This is progress for MLS, right?
I think it makes sense. I mean, obviously, like, especially in Seattle, would we rather be playing games in June than, you know, playing games in November that are not within the playoffs? Yes, but now the most important games are going to be in the most weather-neutral time of the year. And after the Sounders played in 30-degree temperatures in Minnesota in the playoffs, I feel like that's a positive. And it puts their playoffs at a time where people are going to be paying way more attention to them, and you're not scheduling around the NFL games. So I think a lot of wins from that standpoint. Also, in MLS news, for next year, all Apple TV Plus subscribers will have access to MLS games rather than having a specific MLS pass. So that important for your chances of actually watching the Sounders play next season.
Also, can we just throw out there, Torrey Horton didn't play in this game.
He did not. It's true. And they're still working Rashid Shaheed in.
I think the importance of Torrey Horton might be slightly underrated.
Wasn't a great revenge game for Cooper Kupp. All right, in some Sounders-specific news, Joao Paulo announced on Instagram that he's, quote, moving on from the Sounders after six seasons in Seattle. Nico Moreno had reported the Sounders' expected decision not to pick up his 2026 option. Sounder further reported the Sounders offered him a coaching position, but Joao Paulo wishes to continue his playing career at age 34. Moreno also reported the Sounders declined an option for winger Ryan Kent. So we'll see if he might be back on a different deal. All right, Seattle Storm offseason update. The WNBA draft lottery will be Sunday at 3:30 p.m. The Storm, despite making the playoffs last year, enter with the third best odds at the number one pick. 17% chances thanks to the Los Angeles Sparks, easy for me to say, and the trade these two teams made 2 years ago that cleared cap space for Skylar Diggins and Neko Gumake. They are overwhelmingly likely to pick no worse than fourth, which is the pick they gave up in that trade, albeit in what was considered a much stronger draft. And their most likely spot to end in the draft is third. That happens 34% of the time, according to her hoop stats. 2026 draft, pretty wide open at the top. There's not a single dominant prospect like we've seen the last couple of years with Caitlin Clark and Paige Beckers. Scouts are very high on Spanish center Awa Pham, who is playing for Valencia in the EuroLeague. There's less clarity on the top American products with UCLA center Lauren Betts, UConn wing AZ Fudd, LSU guard Flauje Johnson, and TCU guard Olivia Miles all in the mix. I think we have pretty conclusively seen by now why Olivia Miles was willing to go back in the draft and did not expect the Storm to take her number two over Dominique Malunga a year ago. I mean, if Dominique Malunga was in this draft, she would be the certain number one pick. There would not even be any debate about it.
Okay.
So this is a chance for the Storm to add another young talent to her as part of this future core that they have built while not being in the lottery themselves or not being out of the playoffs themselves other than the 1 year. So, you know, very exciting opportunity here.
Who is your ideal? I mean, the season hasn't happened yet, so you know
it has started. But yes,
but like conference play hasn't started.
I mean, so even though, you know, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, new Storm head coach Sonia Rahman talked about Dominique Malunga is positionless and wanting to develop her that way. Like, I think they certainly could draft Awa Pham. I don't think drafting a post up center and Lauren Betts to play with Malunga makes a lot of sense. Olivia Miles, for the same reasons we talked about last year, could make some sense, but I do think Flauje Johnson and AZ Fudd are the players I'm looking at is.
I mean, AZ Fudd would be like, fans would be so excited.
They would. I mean, you know, she's off to a terrific start this year. The question with her is her ability to stay healthy. She's, you know, had a number of knee injuries throughout her time at UConn, unfortunately, that have limited her availability. I got to see Flage Johnson. I've seen Fudd play before, but I got to see Flage Johnson, in addition to Betts, play in person last year in the regionals. And she is like the kind of player whose athleticism really translates better to the well-spaced floor in the WNBA. Like, if you were talking about one player to drop into the 2025 Storm to take them to the next level, I think it's probably Flage Johnson, although AZ Fudd's shooting would obviously be extremely valuable to the Storm as well.
Yeah, I feel like shooting was something that they needed pretty desperately.
But just like her size and ability, she's basically a bigger version of what the Storm hoped Brittany Sykes would be. And maybe a slightly better shooter, too. Flage. And also, by far, the best rapper in the draft, even if rap is dead.
Flage Johnson?
Yes. UW women's basketball, we mentioned this at the top with the Xavier Sellers Conference Player of the Week, got a 72-61 win Saturday at Utah in their toughest non-conference test, remained number 25 in the rankings. I was a little surprised they didn't move up at all, but I guess, you know, the teams around them didn't lose. Their first true road game of the season, Sellers led the way with 30 points on 12 of 23 shooting, while Hannah Steins had 14 points and 8 boards. The Huskies continue to play without their leading scorer from last year, Elle Dean. Still no update as to why she isn't playing. Huskies overcame foul trouble, limiting center Yulia Grabovskaya to 11 minutes, held Utah to 25 second-half points to break open a game that was tied at halftime. They'll be home now for an extended stretch. On Wednesday, they host Fresno State, which is 3-1 with all three of those blowout wins against sub-300 competition, including Seattle U, before losing by 20 at BYU on Saturday. And I guess it's not a conference matchup anymore. Hasn't been for a while. Vermont comes in on Sunday, a sneaky, difficult opponent. The Catamounts are 4-0. They haven't played anybody yet, but won the America East last year, beat Missouri by 16 in their season opener at home, then lost by 20 at NC State in the NCAA tournament as a 15 seed. UW men's basketball, Friday night, went over to Pullman and beat the Cougs 81-69, led by as many as 22 before the Cougs that made things interesting with a 15-2 run. But Washington State never got back closer than 8 before the Huskies closed the win out. Wesley Yates III led the way in that one with 26 points on 9 of 16 shooting, including 4 threes. Hannah Steinbach had 14 points and 13 boards despite rolling an anchor. And Zoom Diallo got the start and scored 20 points. Tuesday night, Huskies welcome Southern. We teased this is a more complicated game than it might have looked on paper against a SWAC opponent. And boy, did the Jaguars make that look true for this game, as they led nearly the entire first half, at times by double digits, led deep into the game. And then in overtime, had the Huskies on the ropes, down 5 with 24 seconds left before improbably blowing the lead by trapping and giving up a Wesley Yates 3 in the corner. And then fouling Kamari Peterson, shooting a 3. He made all 3 shots. And then after splitting 2 free throws, Southern, some missed free throws in there, is usually their case. Peterson comes down to the other end, makes the left-hand layup to tie the game, force a second overtime. And there, the Huskies finally looked like the Big Ten team that aspires to go to the NCAA tournament against the SWAC team.
All it took was 44 minutes, something like that.
Well, yeah, 44 minutes and 35 seconds. And then they had it all the way after that.
Zoom Diallo fouled out of this game in 17 minutes.
It's truly improbable how quickly he fouled out.
I mean, how much of a factor do you think that was?
Well, so here's the situation if we go into it. So Hannah Steinbach didn't play in this one. The Huskies did get Desmond Claude back, which is very important. Crucially important, one might say. You know, because they just needed the bodies. But with Diallo fouled out, with no Steinbach, they end up for much of the overtime because Glaude hit his minutes limit and was kind of limping around out there. Definitely did not seem like he should be playing as badly as the Huskies obviously wanted to win this game. So much of double OT, the Huskies go to true freshman Jasheer Rencher, who had barely played at all this season. Ended up scoring 8 points and grabbing 4 rebounds in 18 minutes. Some crucial contributions from him. But Kamari Peterson played 50 minutes in this one.
Yeah,
every single minute.
That has to be a Husky record, right?
I maybe they've played like a quadruple overtime at some point. JJ Mandakwit played 42. Claude, despite his minutes limit, which was way less than that, played 34 minutes. Because Wesley Yates was also the third, was also in foul trouble. He ended up playing 37 minutes in anyway. Frank Kepdong was in foul trouble, ended up fouling up. He played 32 minutes. And yeah, I mean that they were really, really outmanned in terms of depth by Southern, which is not where you expect to be, but they have had a massive amount of injuries
Yeah,
early in the
tons of injuries.
season.
I okay, so this is maybe not a panic as much because of when you look at it, Hannes Steinbach's not playing, obviously. And Zoom Diallo, for all intents and purposes, like only playing 17 minutes, you know, he's missed at least a half, right? They were just so undermanned in this game that it's maybe not panic time to have played such a close game with Southern.
I definitely don't think it's panic time. I mean, it's they should have played better. The decision making was very questionable at times. Kamari Peterson, as many amazing things as he did, shot 4 of 16 from the field. Desmond Claude was a game changer for them, having him back. He had 20 points, 6 boards, but committed 4 turnovers. Wesley Yates had 5 turnovers, including a really brutal one in the first overtime that helped Southern get back into this. The Huskies weren't able to press their size advantage as much as I think you would prefer to see, in part because of the foul trouble. But you would like to see them do better there. It's not a performance you feel good about, but to your point earlier about you don't move that much in the actual rankings. Like, they dropped 5 spots at KenPom. Like,
I mean, that's actually a pretty huge movement, to be honest.
no, they
All
dropped more than that when they only beat Denver by 14, because Denver is an extremely bad team, whereas part of what
Have they moved
the
up at all at any point? Has anything good happened in KenPom yet?
yeah they started out they moved up 3 spots after beating Arkansas Pine Bluff by 44, and they
Nice.
did move
I
up
pulled
two
up
spots.
bracketology. Robbie Hummel's back. What is the who is this dude for Purdue?
I don't know. Oh, you're talking about Braden Smith.
Is that number two for them?
Yeah, he's the consensus National Player of the Year. I didn't quite get your joke here. I don't think
Okay.
he looks that much like Robbie. Apparently, Purdue has a really tall guy again. I haven't watched them play. But someone made a good joke on social media about they go around to every village asking them if they have a giant. Yeah, they have a 7'4" dude, Daniel Jacobson.
Time is a flat circle for Purdue basketball, for Husky basketball, for all things, for Seahawks football. We are back. We are
I was
back, and this is
prepared.
the year 2012 again.
Had the Huskies lost this, I was prepared to say meet the new dogs, same as the old dogs. They made a point of pointing out in the broadcast that the Huskies were like 15-2 in non-conference play at home the last 2 years, and I'm like, that's actually not that good. I mean, their loss 2 years ago was totally fine. That was to Nevada in Mike Hopkins' final year, but last year their home loss was to Seattle U, which finished the year ranked about where Southern is now, and they lost that one by 9. If you go back 2 years, they lost to Cal Baptist, another team that finished
Oh
about
my
where
God.
they are ranked, where Southern is ranked. And then 2022, we thought that 2021, when they lost to Montana, it was a worrisome sign in the midst of a 5-21 season. But their all-time worst non-conference loss was the 2022 season opener to Northern Illinois, who finished that season 9-21. They immediately lost their next 5 games, including to number 328 Arkansas Little Rock, and finished season 6-14 in the MAC conference.
So they only have a couple more opportunities to lose a real bad one here.
Let's see. I haven't looked too closely at the schedule yet. Southern Utah and
Southern Utah
San
and Seattle
Diego.
U and San Diego. Those are
Seattle
like,
U wouldn't actually be that bad of a loss. Seattle U's decent. Nice win over. They crushed Eastern by 27. That was a
Cool.
nice win for them. They didn't beat Denver as badly as UW did. I mean, obviously the Huskies should win the game, but that also is not a home game.
Okay, what's next for Husky
That one's
basketball?
a clip. What's next is the week off. They get a chance to rest and recuperate and hopefully get healthy after this one as they point ahead to the Acrisure Holiday Classic starting on Saturday.
Hello, which we own.
I mean,
We own the Acrisure
the other thing I will say
Invitational.
about this one is clearly the Huskies were looking ahead to the Acrisure Holiday Classic. They've had that circled all year long.
Are you going to this game, Climate Pledge Arena, December 19th?
Probably not, but you never know.
That's a Friday night.
The last time before this, the Huskies had played double OT was against Seattle U in 2023.
A weekend night around the holidays is a pretty valuable night
You're
to
gonna have to
spend.
go looking for Christmas lights.
Oh, there's all sorts of Christmas plans that you got to work in there, you know? I was thinking about that. Like what we're gonna do, you have to outline. And I'm missing two nights. There's a them show, and then I'm gonna be in New York for a period of time. So I'm losing like three Christmas season Saturdays, which is almost why the Christmas season should be longer.
I suppose. I actually will not be here. I'm going to be in Salt Lake City on that Friday, now that I think about it. So,
What could you possibly do be doing in Salt Lake City?
a little thing called Stay Tuned.
Wow. Is it coming up later on this podcast?
No.
Oh,
You
stay.
have to stay tuned for a longer period of time than just however long is left in this podcast.
What is it?
Stay tuned. Not
What is it
announced yet.
pertaining to? Not announced yet?
Yeah.
Is it a live podcast?
Yes, I'm doing a live podcast without you.
Not a
No, it is
Pelton
not that.
cast.
Oh, you were no, it is not a Hoop Collective
Is it an
podcast.
ESPN related thing?
It is not ESPN related.
What could you po this is a life stay tuned?
I no, this is a basketball. Stay tuned. Stay tuned. In the meantime, while
Are
you're
you going to tell me
pondering this,
offline?
sure, I can tell you offline.
I'm going to be frantically looking as meaning the why would any person be in Salt Lake in December? I thought there were whole film festivals who determined they didn't want to do that anymore.
While you're pondering that, let's talk about Husky football, which rallied from their loss at Wisconsin with a 49-13 win Saturday over Purdue, where they looked completely dominant offensively despite playing without Jonah Coleman, who warmed up for the game but did not end up dressing after he didn't feel comfortable physically. Denzel Boston, their leading receiver, didn't play in this one. Two starting offensive linemen did not play in this. And it just did not matter as the Huskies were able to move the ball seemingly at will after a very brief, slow start to this one, before I think you even got there.
Are you going to Lakers Jazz on December 18th in Salt Lake?
Actually, I'm not. No. This is obviously more in the ballpark.
I am Kilby Block Party is not until next year.
So do you want to talk about this game, or do you just want to speculate?
On what you're doing in December in Salt Lake City? Yeah, I think I'm going to focus on the speculating on what you're doing in Salt
Oh,
Lake City.
you know what? I'm gonna put a moratorium on it.
It has to be a shared more. We agreed that you can't be a one-sided moratorium. It has to be unanimous moratorium. Moratorium rejected. I'm so excited we're getting into moratoriums on the podcast. This is an important, we're reaching a new level of the
We
Peltoncast
might
right
need a
now.
moratorium rejected graphic, Griffin Pullman. Not
Moratorium
Griffin Pullman, I did it
rejected.
again.
But you said his name wrong?
I did.
Oh, you did. What did you call him?
Griffin
Pullman?
Pullman is what I always call him because the
The city in Washington State.
I'm
I
aware of what it is. Yes.
swear, Washington State University is
Oh.
actually. Put the Pullman campus.
The
Blake
WSU Vancouver
Corum.
campus is
Blake
not in Pullman.
Corum. I just
Pretty
can't
long.
believe like Blake Corum's not seared into your brain.
The national championship game isn't that distressing a memory to me, or
It's
that strong a memory to me.
a mildly distressing memory to me. I just remember there being one, it was a holding on a deep ball that I was pretty furious about. But it was kind of like this team is just better. They're just better.
Well, you know who's not better was Purdue.
Okay. Oh, Purdue football. Yep. I'm gonna go get a I have a coffee being made. I'm gonna go grab it. I'll be back. Which they don't serve in the East End Zone anymore. I went down there. I looked for it. I was trying to get a coffee. It was cold. It was rainy. It was gross. No coffee.
What a
I don't want a
dynamite
Pepsi,
segue.
people.
Okay, if you're out there listening from the UW football concessions, get coffee in the East End Zone.
Gandhi.
Don't know how many people are going to get that reference.
Just for me. Doesn't matter.
It's also for me. Anyways, did you have any takeaways from attending UW Purdue?
I think the most important thing from that game was the news that came out after about Rayden Vines-Bright seeming
That's
like
true, yes.
his injury was not serious. I mean, there was talk about him playing this coming week, which I was just like, don't do that. I don't care. Like, that is not a good decision in general. But
We'll leave that to the medical professionals. But yes, he suffered a concussion in a scary looking situation. We couldn't see anything of the hit itself in the stadium, but obviously anytime that some player has to leave the field on a stretcher via an ambulance, it's disconcerting. It was good to hear very quickly that, he was, responsive and had movement in his extremities, and that, obviously a scary concussion is a very scary injury, but that it wasn't anything worse or scarier than that, particularly on a day where the Huskies were celebrating their 2000 Rose Bowl team that played against Purdue and beat them in the Rose Bowl, that Curtis Williams was paralyzed as part of that season. So.
yeah, I mean that honestly was one of the biggest takeaways. But DeMond played another phenomenal game. Didn't have to run the ball like he sometimes has to, which I was really happy with. I mean, even the 7 carries felt like too much to me at some point. But the 16 of 19 for 257 yards, 2 touchdowns, was just, I mean, it was a borderline perfect game from DeMond. The ball that he hit to Audrick Harris down the middle of the field, it was one of those ones where you see him open and you're just like, he freaking did it again. He did it again. He throws that ball perfectly every single time. So, got a bunch of different receivers involved in this one, which was nice. I mean, the fact that they beat Purdue, which actually that was interesting that it didn't affect their overall FPI that much, but the fact that they beat Purdue so badly without Jonah Coleman, without Denzel Boston, was, I thought it was a pretty impressive victory, including the offensive line injuries. Like this was an overall, this is the best game they played all year.
Was the largest margin of defeat for Purdue all season. Obviously, they're winless in the Big Ten, but had generally been competitive, as we talked about last week. And you mentioned the number of receivers that they were able to get involved. They also, were able to get more running backs involved because Jonah Coleman didn't play. Jordan Washington saw his most extensive action of
Oh,
the
Jordan
season.
Washington looks good.
I mean, track speed, 68-yard touchdown, very impressive. But his other 4 carries went for 40 yards as well. Adam Muhammad, not as explosive a day, but gets in the end zone 3 times as the starter in place of Jonah Coleman. And then in the fourth quarter, true freshman Quade Carr had a carry for 8 yards and a catch. And then Rykin Moon, after we'd
Yeah,
left this
we
game,
didn't see any Rykin Moon, but.
four carries for 22 yards. So. Getting people involved, and it was nice to see the run game play so well. You perform so well with injuries on the offensive line and Coleman also out. I mean, I guess one of my takeaways is, frankly, it's a little frustrating that the Huskies looked so good in this game because it did make you think, like, what might have been. Like, the path to actually making the playoff was very, the odds were very slim, and we would have put a moratorium on it, but we saw why there was a path. Had they not lost at Wisconsin. So,
Yep. Had they not lost at Wisconsin.
famous last words, had they not lost at Wisconsin.
I love Za'Darius Treney-Sale. Looks awesome.
Oh,
The
yeah.
defense in general. Like even the pass rush, they did a really good job with like running quarterbacks, Malachi Singleton being at 11 carries for 22 yards. I thought they did a very, very good job with both of them. Got some pressure in this game. I don't know. It was a complete game.
It was. So now they try to do the same at UCLA in what might be their final regular season game ever for the Huskies at the Rose Bowl, with the Bruins reportedly trying to move to SoFi Stadium as soon as next season. Jed Fish said that Jonah Coleman has, quote, a really good chance of playing in this one after not suiting up last week, likely to stick with the same offensive line that saw true freshman John Mills kick out to right tackle against Purdue, with Pacquiao Finau replacing him at his more natural left guard spot. And then Zach Henning, starting at center in place of the injured Garion Hatchett, had a couple of issues early on with snaps, including one that went comically far over Damon Williams Jr.'s head. We can laugh about it now after a 49-13 win. Pretty frustrating in the moment. And another that Damon Williams Jr. turned into one of the most amazing 6-yard plays of the season. So UCLA, they started the season 0-3. Then they fired DeShaun Foster after getting outscored by Utah, UNLV, and New Mexico by an average of 21.7 points per game. They enjoyed a shocking stretch under interim coach Tim Skipper, winning three in a row in Big Ten play, starting with a 42-37 win over Penn State that cost James Franklin his job and set up Virginia Tech to hire him, and then now have lost three in a row, although it's pretty understandable given two of the three were against literally the top two teams in the country. They were competitive against Nebraska, playing a backup quarterback at home in between. Overall, this UCLA team looks on paper a lot like Wisconsin, 71st in FPI. They're 91st in FPI efficiency this season, two spots behind the Badgers, 67th in offense, 103rd in defense, 88th in special teams. But obviously the big difference, I would say, is you're not going to have the weather that was a factor in the Wisconsin game. And, you know, as much as Wisconsin represented the continued challenges of playing against these traditional Big Ten teams that are built around, you know, power and the run, that is, suffice it to say, not UCLA.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest question is basically whether Nico Iamaleva is playing in this game. And it seems like things are trending in that direction. You know, he's taking part in drills right now, but that would be one of the biggest differences as well. Like, obviously, they lost to Ohio State. They lost to Indiana very badly. Nico didn't play last week against Ohio State. And
although Luke Duncan made his first career start, actually did pretty well, all things considered, against Ohio State. 16 of 23 for 154 yards, was not sacked, did not turn the ball over. As you said, Nico Iamaleva reportedly participating in drills, still don't know his availability for Saturday. And, you know, frankly, part of the reason it might not have made that big of a difference is that as much discussion as there was about Iamaleava with his late transfer from Tennessee and, you know, his NIL demands, has not frankly justified all the talk. He's averaging just 6.4 yards per completion, has run for a career high 474 yards and four touchdowns on the ground. Three of those and 128 yards came in their win over Penn State, but overall he's 10th in the Big Ten.
I don't know if I agree with that necessarily. Struggled early on, like the game against New Mexico, losing 35-10 New Mexico. He played terrible in that game. But there is a Nico Iamaleva who can play at a very high level and better than, you know, Ryan Brown or honestly most of the quarterbacks across the Big Ten outside of, you know, your kind of top tier of quarterbacks. But like in the Nebraska game, he was 17-25, 191 yards passing for a 90 QBR, 15 carries for 86 yards. Like he's a threat in a lot of ways. Against Penn State, it was a similar thing, 96 QBR, 96.7 QBR, which might be better.
The ball that effectively.
And that was 16 carries for 128 yards. You know, that probably was better than any game DeMond has had this season statistically.
He had a 99.6 QBR at Washington State, so I'm going to say no to that.
Okay, fair enough. But it's close. So there is, Nico has the ability to play at an extraordinarily high level. He hasn't been consistent this year. And there's a brutal performance against Indiana in there. And then there's some fine performances against, which frankly is like a pretty good defensive Big Ten overall. That,
oh yeah.
UW is not necessarily not part of that pretty good defensive Big Ten overall as well. You know, like what they did against Purdue, they're sitting at 41st in FPI efficiency defensively.
They were 60th a couple weeks ago. So they have improved dramatically with in the loss to Wisconsin and the win over Purdue.
I think this defense is definitely getting better throughout the year, and they've shown a lot in these situations. I mean, it's really special teams where the team has been mostly bad, like if you look at the different avenues. And I think looking at UCLA, I mean, let's talk about their defense, I guess.
Well, the rest of their offense, it's the running backs have not really been capable of taking the advantage of the attention paid to Iamaleava is a rusher. Nobody has reached 300 yards on the ground this season with three different backs getting at least 50 carries. Their top receiving threat is sophomore Kwasi Gilmer, who has 432 yards receiving, three TDs. But defense has been the swing factor for UCLA. They're 1-6 this season when allowing at least 28 points, have won two of the three times they've allowed fewer than that, which have all been 17 or fewer. And not coincidentally, in those three wins, they forced four turnovers as compared to four in all seven other seven games combined. They have allowed at least 199 yards on the ground five times and only held one opponent below 125 rushing yards. And their opponent average of 5.2 yards per carry ranks 17th in the Big Ten ahead of only Rutgers. Pass defense has been halfway decent, but because of the fact that they've constantly been trailing and have been gashed on the ground, has not been tested yet. So this is a game where if Jonah Coleman does return to the lineup, he should have a chance to really eat against this Bruins defense.
Are they the worst Big Ten team, or is Rutgers worse?
Rutgers is worse against the Rush.
Are they worse overall, though?
In terms of FBI efficiency?
Yeah, I think they might be the worst. No, Rutgers is still worse. But Rutgers is one of the worst defenses. Oh, my God. They are the second worst Big Ten team defensively, though. Right next to Purdue, in fact. It is 102 and 103 defensively. That game was at home. The Huskies scored 49 points against Purdue.
I was there. Can confirm. So, I mean, I didn't see the last 7 points, so I don't know if I can confirm the total.
They also, against Rutgers, scored 38 points and scored them in a hurry in that game. So, you know, this game, I think, is going to come down to... A lot of people are nervous about this one, which I guess I'm not surprised that they're nervous, because the Huskies are playing a road game. And pretty much any time they're playing a road game has been warranted to be nervous about the outcome of those. I mean, they've only won two of them this year, right? And one of them was at Wazoo. Pretty tough Wazoo team.
I would say the Washington State is in the same ballpark as these teams in terms of FPI. And another case where it was a familiar environment, it was not a hostile environment. UCLA is not going to be a hostile environment. Like, I have appropriate fear here for, you know, all the reasons you laid out about what UCLA has done when they've been at their best. But I'm not nervous specifically about this game.
The Cougs are better defensively than the Huskies are.
Than the Bruins are, or than the Huskies are?
Than the Huskies are. No, they're number 36 defensively.
Wow, they've gotten it together.
They would be like a middle high Big Ten team defensively, the Cougs. Okay. So, I mean, it's basically just like, how much do you factor in the Huskies playing on the road as a thing? Like, I guess
I don't believe we'll in it. Learn. I mean, I believe in it is the Huskies in the elements, which, you know, they also were fortunate. That bad snap that happened against the first bad snap, the comically bad snap that happened last Saturday, was while it was still, you know, misting rain and still wet and slick. And then immediately after that, the conditions improved. And thankfully, for a November UW home game, was about as nice as it could possibly be.
How does LA look this weekend, though?
I don't think it's like last weekend. I didn't know that we were going to have to look up the weather forecast for LA.
I mean, after last weekend, it does feel like it's necessary. When Saturday night, it is 70 degrees and sunny.
Sounds amazing.
Wow.
I would like to go to there.
I should move to this fucking place. What am I doing here in Seattle?
There is 0.84 inches of rain on Thursday. That is, I don't know how they're going to handle that.
So I guess we'll see how much the... People have blamed Jed Fish and been like, Jed Fish teams aren't good on the road. Carte blanche. Which, I granted, they have every right to complain about it with how good the team was at home versus how good they were on the road last year. They were bad on the road. And they lost to bad teams on the road last year.
They lost to a worse one this year.
With the losses, that one we shouldn't throw it out completely, but the elements were a pretty big factor in that game against Wisconsin. And they're not going to be a factor at all in this one. UCLA doesn't have the kind of defense that Ohio State has, that Michigan has, where they scored zero touchdowns against Ohio State, one against Michigan, and then one against Wisconsin. That is the recipe for losing a game for the Huskies, is for some reason... I mean, not for some reason. Ohio State and Michigan, I get why their offense wasn't as good. The speed that they have to shut down DeMond when he is scrambling, like, those teams are capable of doing it. They have the speed, they have the discipline, they have everything, right? They're some of the best defensive teams in the country. UCLA is not that recipe. It is a pretty good Husky defense overall and a great Husky offense playing against a bad UCLA defense in perfect elements. So... this doesn't seem to have the recipe of the type of game that is going to be difficult for the Huskies. I think people are a little bit too nervous about it, and I think they're more nervous about it because of the history on the road. I get it. Overall, it's fucking UCLA, though. Like,
they're more nervous because of Wisconsin specifically.
But it's like a be real. Like, I could have told you, and I have been literally saying this for years. I said this preseason. Going at Wisconsin is not the same as going at UCLA. So there are a lot of programs across the Big Ten that it is difficult to go to. UCLA is not one of those schools.
Might lose this game, but I don't think they're going to lose it because of any magical difficulty. Like, it's not a time zone issue here. They're not changing those. It's not going to be long travel. They might lose the game, but it's going to be because they don't play to their capabilities. And because they fall behind.
This game is, I don't even know if they fall behind. Nico has to play out his fucking mind. Like, UCLA has to play a type of game similar to what they played against Penn State.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, are they capable of it? Probably. I mean, there's also injuries on the offensive line for UCLA. You know, they had that little stretch in the middle of the season. Literally their wins, right? The wins are sandwiched between a bunch of losses on either side. So that stretch, they looked pretty good there for a second. But it would take one of those performances to do something like what they did against Penn State. Do I see it happening? Probably not in this one.
Do you expect an outlier performance? Percentage chances of victory?
80%.
I am going to say 75%.
What is the, like, the spread? Pretty play. Big.
It is.
It's, yeah, 11.5. It's gone down. It opened at 11.5 and it's now 10.5. So.
Oh, getting tight.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of large spreads, your Seattle Seahawks facing the Tennessee Titans on Sunday in Nashville. The Titans are last in DVOA, and per Aaron Schatz, no number 32 team, or no last place team, I should say, has ever beaten the number one team since DVOA has been calculated back to 1978.
Wow. I guess the opportunities haven't been that many, but.
But over, you know, that's getting close to 50 years of
football. It must happen at least once every year, I would assume.
No, I wouldn't assume it necessarily happens every year. But especially if they're in the same division, you'd have a chance to some years have two, I guess.
Yeah. Well, so. All right. That's all I have to say.
I considered not doing as extensive notes on the Titans, but
the Titans,
you know,
didn't even deserve the notes.
No, I gave them the respect, appropriate fear. Their lone win came 22-21 versus Arizona in week 5. Despite that, they fired Brian Callahan a week later. With senior offensive assistant Mike McCoy taking over, have been competitive lately. They lost 27-20 to the Chargers 2 weeks ago, 16-13 at home to the Texans with Davis Mills at quarterback last week at home. Although the Titans scored just 13 points in that game, Cam Ward did have a season-high 58 QBR, notably converted 7 of 15 dropbacks on third and fourth downs to goose his EPA. For the season, he's number 33 in EPA plus CPOE composite, ahead of only two other ahead of two other rookies, Dylan Gabriel and JJ McCarthy. Better than average is a rookie at avoiding interceptions as the number one pick, but second lowest completion percentage, that's ahead of McCarthy, and second lowest yards per attempt, that's ahead of Gabriel. So the three of those guys all kind of in a group as rookie quarterbacks this season, but one of them taken in a slightly different place than the others. Did you ever imagine as the Huskies were beating Cam Ward in the 2020, narrowly beating Cam Ward in the 2023 Apple Cup, that he was going to be the number one pick in the draft?
No, not at all. Yeah. Well, I thought he was good. But...
Yeah, no, I mean, he played well. Not like a criticism, but like most quarterbacks are not drafted number one overall is the thing.
That's actually true.
No, it's a scientific fact. I used AI to determine it. Tennessee is banged up at receiver. Kelvin Ridley suffered a fractured fibula on Sunday, so obviously out for the year. Well, Chimere DK suffered a chest contusion and left that one, and Elik Aominor played through a hamstring injury. For the season, tight end Chigo Conquo leads the team in both receptions and yards. They have not been effective rushing either. They are 31st in EPA per play on the ground. Veteran Tony Pollard is averaging 3.9 yards per attempt. Meanwhile, their defense ranks 26th in EPA per play allowed on both rushes and dropbacks. They have forced just one turnover in their last four games, and opponents are completing 71% of the passes, the second highest in the league, for 7.7 yards per attempt. Titans do have a couple of old friends on defense, even after releasing Quandre Diggs as well as Tyler Lockett. Cody Barton leads the team with three interceptions, including a pick six, while Jerry
Hello.
Jones has 4.5 sacks to rank
Cody Barton's
seventh for
everywhere.
receivers on the team. Well, he only plays for one team at a time, but he has gone to
No,
a variety of
he's
different
all
teams.
over the field, is what I'm saying.
Oh,
Like
okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Cody Barton is like, when you watch them, Cody Barton is notable.
Do you watch the Titans?
Yeah, they pop up on red zone.
Okay.
You don't think so? I mean, they played some close games.
He actually has consistently gotten a lot of interceptions. He has eight over the last four seasons that he's
Cody Barton's
the four
playing
seasons
great.
as a starter. A Seahawks draft success story, just not for the Seahawks. Anything else to say about this one?
I was seeing where he's at in PFF grade. Not great. Actually, worse than I was expecting. No, I have nothing else to say. I don't know. What is there to take from this game?
Percentage chances of victory.
95%.
Well, it's not that high. It's an NFL road game. But I would say 85%.
I mean, you are talking about something that has literally never happened.
It is kind of, I mean, it's kind of shocking that it's never happened. Like, logic demands, there were so many, like, what was the game last week? I don't know what was the most shocking outcome last week. I guess the Browns nearly beating the Ravens. And granted, those teams are nowhere. The Ravens are not near number one in DVOA, and the Browns are not quite number 32. They're only 31.
There were a lot of near miss games last week.
Right.
And so none that actually played out. I mean, if the Giants had beaten the Packers, wouldn't have been like all time notable. I mean, the Bills getting crushed by the Dolphins, I think, is one
Yes.
that I definitely wouldn't have, because it wasn't even close. So, but you know, where are the Dolphins in DVOA? They're not dead last.
No,
And the
not anywhere
Bills
close.
definitely are not the best team.
The biggest upsets by point spread in NFL history appear to be 17 and a
Yeah,
half.
point spread. I'm sure that there's been, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the number one team in DVOA.
But the point is, like, there's nothing about that this is a smaller spread than that.
Yeah. No, I don't actually think it wouldn't be a historically bad loss outside of the DVOA piece, because the spread is, what is 12 and a half now?
13 and a half.
13 and a half. Oh yeah, that opened at 12 and a half and got moved up to 13 and a half. So I just kind of think the Seahawks are going to comfortably win this game, though. And it's similar to kind of what we talked about with the Seahawks last week against Purdue. That had the revenge game factor as well for Ryan Walters. This one is sort of just like they've got to blow off some steam after a tough game against the Rams. And I do think Darnold is going to have a very good game. Real revenge game comes for him next week.
This sets up quite well for Sam Darnold, for the Seahawks in general. I mean, that's the thing about it, is it's not just that it's the best team and the worst team. It's that their weaknesses match up with what the Seahawks want to do.
Cam Ward is going to be in hell in this game against the
It
Seahawks defense. It is not
it's gonna be a
anything
tough
Cam
one.
Ward wants to deal with, is the Seahawks defense. Like, this is a like, you know, it's far enough in the season that he doesn't need a welcome to the NFL moment right now, but that just the
And also
way
that
that they
he's
move.
gotten
Yeah. Yeah. He has been sufficiently welcomed to the NFL.
thoroughly welcomed.
They lost to the Raiders.
I believe the 26-0 shutout loss at Houston, where he went 10 of 26 for 108 yards in an interception, that was probably real welcome to the NFL moment.
But the way that the Seahawks defense hits and how fast they are, I think it is going to be like they're just not, you know, they haven't played the
I guess
Eagles or
his
something, somebody like
debut
that.
was 12 and 20, 12 of 28 for 112 yards against the
Another
Broncos.
very good defense as
Sacked
well.
six times. I mean, yes, right up there with the Seahawks.
So.
He had a net 1.82 yards per attempt in that game.
And I think that's kind of what we should expect in this one as well from Cam Ward and the Titans offense. Defense isn't that much better either. The thing I would like to see in it here, how about this, is the Seahawks are going to win comfortably. I would love to see a just kind of getting back to what they do, like the early down play action stuff, motion, but also running the ball well, having a week where they just the line got to just have a game where the Seahawks actually were a successful run team. And I mean, I think it's going to be back to the boring football that they were playing. They played one fun game right in the middle of everything, but let's get back to some of that boring football that we saw.
I mean, they're playing at 10 a.m. You know, 10 a.m. is a good time for a boring Seahawks team. When they're playing on Sunday Night Football, that's not as fun because there's nothing else to flip over to. But, you know, let me flip over to Red Zone for the end of the for the witching hour.
We have a little heart monitor thing that Mateo was monitoring very closely while he was sick last week.
he was concerned about his heart.
And I was like, it was, well, it was oxygen was the main thing.
I see. How's he doing?
He's fine. But the
how's his fantasy team doing?
Oh my God, I am devastated. Absolutely devastated. He didn't have Josh Allen in the lineup.
Yeah, that was a rough one to not have Josh Allen in there. Do you have Jalen Hurts instead?
He had Justin Herbert. And I was like, you Ooh. Trust those people.
Oh, Justin Herbert had the higher projection?
I meant people from Oregon.
Oh.
But no, I was like, we should take the heart monitor and do it like right when they announce the witching hour on Red Zone and see how high my heart monitor goes.
Oh boy, it was wow. It's good thing you had Kenneth Gainwell in there.
Kenneth Gainwell had a great game.
He gained very well.
But no, if he would have had Travis Kelce and Josh Allen in, like I think he would have won. I didn't look, but
he definitely could have used Debo as well. I mean, his opponent had 121 points, so he would have needed a lot. But
what is the difference between Josh Allen? The difference between Josh Allen and Justin Herbert is 40 points.
Yeah, it was about 39, and he lost by 52.
Okay, so if it would have been,
I guess Kelce
Kelce
and Allen would have been sufficient. He wouldn't, or Debo Samuel in place of Devontae Smith.
I set his lineup for him in that game. And I was like, Mateo's going to want it. I was like, Dallas Goedert and Travis Kelce have about the same projections. And so I was like, I'm going to leave in Dallas Goedert just because.
Goedert had a better projection.
That's why I was like, the projection's good. And that's what Mateo would want. But just the superhuman Josh Allen performance. And I didn't realize he wasn't in. And I was just like, oh my God. Like every one of the rushing touchdowns, which I was playing against James Cook in both leagues, which is just like not fun when that happens. But I was really excited about how Josh Allen kept running in all the scores instead of James Cook. See George Pickens the other night? I think you might have talked shit about George Pickens.
Did I?
I don't know, maybe not.
I did because I mean, not that it mattered. I was hopelessly behind for a variety of reasons, but CeeDee Lamb was not got I had a fine game, but was not getting as many passes as
Ted McMillan being up to a top 10 fantasy receiver also. Man, there's so many of the flyers that I took where I was just like, they all freaking hit. And neither of my teams are that good.
Well, I'm going to need you to make the playoffs in both leagues if I'm going to be in the Champions League.
That's your really cheering for me. I'm like right on the cusp in both.
In hindsight, I regret beating you. You know,
I know, you should. I regret beating you. You're the only person that Jonathan Taylor who doesn't have a good team.
I've got good players. Like, my running back core is so deep, and yet...
Chemistry issues.
I was, as of last week, number two in opponent points. I don't know if I'm now number one in opponent points.
In opponent points, yeah, that's never fun.
I have my team has allowed 170 more points than yours.
I've scored more than you, though, haven't I?
No, you have not.
Really? You've scored more points than me?
Yeah. I should be very much in the playoff mix.
I mean, again, you have Jonathan Taylor.
And he wasn't even my first round pick.
CD was?
Yeah.
And Dak is having a good year. And Kyron, like, your team looks good.
It is, but whoever of Dak Prescott and Caleb Williams I play, the other has the good
You pick. Have Blake Corum on your team?
Where he exists.
You have him on your team and you don't know his name. You're like Richard White, Kalen Johnson.
I need to get rid of Quentin Johnson. That guy sucks.
Your star tight end, Kyren Pitts Sr. Like, what? That's incredible that you said his name wrong multiple weeks in a row and have him on your fantasy team. He's your fucking handcuff.
Roman Dobbs? Dan Prescott?
Sidarius Lamb. Oh, you really got your ass kicked this last week, didn't you?
Jesus Christ.
Did they have Josh Allen? No. Because Mateo has Josh Allen. Oh, that Jacoby Brissett. Oh, God, George Kittle. I saw him scoring touchdowns, and I was disgusted. Wow, that team is playing a tight end at the flex position.
And
it wasn't.
Possibly playing. But the real one was getting outscored 21-1 on defense was coup de grace.
Yeah, if that hadn't happened, you might have made up those 75 points that you lost by.
I'm just saying that was the chef's kiss element of it.
The coup de grace. You really don't. Dak's been a pretty good quarterback. Yeah, I know you probably should have played him, but who knows?
Caleb Williams had to.
Yeah, when Sean Tucker's running in every touchdown, I'm just like, I hate you to my core, Sean Tucker.
I'm the only one who thinks about the aircraft, the airplane stunt pilot named Sean Tucker.
You definitely are. What?
He performs at Seafair usually.
Sean Tucker.
He goes by Sean D. Tucker, I believe.
Oh, okay. To differentiate himself from the football player.
Exactly.
He was like, there's this guy at Syracuse who's going to go undrafted. He's like, I got to differentiate myself from him. Whenever Sean Tucker breaks out in a couple years here.
All right. We should probably call it there.
He looked very good last week.
He did. I agree.
The Bills. That's another team that the Seahawks are better than. With his 19 carries for 106 yards and 2 touchdowns. A very nice fantasy performance for Sean Tucker. Hope you're happy.
All right. I think that's our cue to go.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
It's what, November 18th? And that's the day. Before I was even in, I was out. And I think I was in for like a chunk of the Baylor game. And then we get in the car, like, because the children want to go looking around for Christmas lights, driving around.
How did Marco feel about this in a callback to last week?
No, he's for looking for the Christmas lights. He wants to do it every night because you could see turkeys out there.
Oh, good point.
It's like probably, I would actually say it's probably like 60-40 Christmas versus Thanksgiving going around the neighborhood.
Decorations or are there Thanksgiving specific lights? How would you do that?
No, there are Thanksgiving specific lights.
Are there?
Well, if there's like, if they are orange and brown lights, those are definitely. I suppose
ours are orange and purple, but they were Halloween, but we've still got those up.
No, jail. Sorry. You're being arrested. If I see a Halloween light, because orange and purple is distinctly Halloween. Sorry.
Maybe I'm just showing my lifelong fandom of the Phoenix Suns.
Straight to jail. Anyway, Luca's like monitoring the score on his phone. We're listening to my iPod Pitchfork Top 100 songs of 2012. We're having a great time.
Wow.
And he's like, oh, the holy, he's like, fucking shit, they're up 5. And I was just like, turn it off your phone. I was like, do not tell me anything else. It's over. I was like, it's over. And then we come back like 20 minutes later and he is like, holy shit, we did it. And I was just like, what? I was like kind of stewing, you know, I was like impressed with the majesty of the Christmas lights, kind of stewing at the same time. Also 2012, all rippers. What a year for music. Good God. I think 2012 is kind of underrated as far as maybe one of the best music years of all time.
I'm trying to find 2012. Let's remember some years.
Did we remember all the way through 2012?
We did. I think I wanted to stop at 2013, but it looks like we went all the way up through 2014. Oh yeah, Frank, the Channel Orange.
Channel Orange.
Yeah.
Good Kid, Mad City are both that year.
Yeah.
There's like Mercy by Kanye.
There's an album called The Heist.
Yeah, that is not in the top 100 songs. You wouldn't believe this. Despite it being the Grammy for...
Let me tell you, we remembered a lot of it in whatever we remembered in 2012.
I am sure that we did. There's Call Me Maybe. It was like an incredible Grimes year. It was really like... every song where you're just like, oh my God, that and that and that.
What about Rack City? That is a song that transports me back to a certain time and a certain place. And that place is, I think it was actually maybe the Lob City version of it.
Lob City,
which was Clippers themed, obviously. That playing it at some high school basketball game I was at, that then Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn was also at the game.
That was a memory. A huge Miguel year.
Was that not on Remember Some Years? Because we should have remembered Miguel.
Goldie by A$AP Rocky and Oldie by Odd Future. Both of those in 2012. I mean, it was like, and then Japandroids. I was telling them about seeing Japandroids at the Sunset. I like to reminisce with the iPod about craziest shows that I've been to. And I actually had this thought, I don't know if this should be saved for, it was also Bloom by Beach House, like the best Beach House record. It was like 2012 was a freaking year for what it's worth.
I don't know how I didn't have that. Yeah. Adorn, for sure.
It was that, and then I was like, Girl Talk. I think Girl Talk is the most specifically millennial music that there is.
This is a great question, and that is a great answer
When people are like, I know there's that thing about Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros being like the worst song of all time. I think we might have talked about that on the podcast, and I really like took offense to that. I didn't take offense to it necessarily because I want to defend it as a song, but there's
Climax.
Exactly. No, that was like the number three song of the year.
I see that. Yeah, I've gone to the Pitchfork list now.
I think there's Only Go Backwards by Tame Impala is in the top 10 also. Like,
yes.
I mean, just like scrolling through that list, you'd be like, damn, this is a freaking, it was a year. 2012.
Swimming Pools ended up 19th on their list.
Well, they have Bitch Don't Kill My Vibe on there, like at number...
Sure, we're trying real hard.
I am not a fan of Swimming Pools either. I wouldn't have had it at all. But Backseat Freestyle is also, I'm assuming, pretty high. They fumbled, though. They didn't realize Money Trees was going to be the song that really lasted from the record. Or not Money... Well, yeah, Money Trees, too. But Mad City, too. Like, those are the ones that I feel like have actually lasted longer than any of those three songs they had. Ironically, one of them because of a Beach House sample. So anyway, I was like, I think that music, because people before it, people who are not millennials, would not understand Girl Talk, because they might not get some of the like musical references, because it's basically like rap music of the time, like frantically mashed up with very different things of like basically the entire history of rock music, right? And yes. So if you're not interested in pop rap music from like 2006 to 2012, like if those aren't things you know, you probably have no interest in this music. And so people before then, not interested. People after post mashup culture, right? Even when I play the Grey album, they're just like, why are you playing this thing for me? Like, this is terrible. And
I
don't
even know about the Notorious XX.
Not interested, not a fan. We were talking the XX also. I think the debut album came out in 2012.
Yes,
though,
that
by
does
the
appear
way.
To be here. Yeah.
Which I'm just telling you, 2012, what a freaking year. But after that, like a lot of those same pop songs are just gone. And the concept of like a mashup record just kind of sounds annoying to children. And they're not going to get as many of the other things, you know, like having a Temple of the Dog on a song, not as exciting to children as you would think. Temple of the Dog with pop rap music over it. Also, it's funny, Bees in the Trap is on that list, which is now, like, are you aware of this? One of the biggest songs in the entire world.
No, I was not aware of that.
There's a TikTok trend with Four Non Blondes into Bees in the Trap. And I was like, it's all right there. All of music hit. The Mayans were right. 2012 was when pop music peaked. That's what they predicted. Anyway, Luca pulls it up and it's like, holy shit, we did it. And I'm like, all right. Fair enough.
Well,
I'll accept it. Like, it is definitely, it's not a good win, but it is a game that the Huskies won. And, you know, a lot of the past coaches might have lost it.
It is true. We talked about this already, obviously. I will tell you that my Girl Talk, like, obviously we listened to an immense amount of Girl Talk for a long period of time. But if I think of a specific moment of listening to Girl Talk, which did not come with you. It was right before I went to a UW men's basketball game.
Really?
And it was the Saturday of the Beast Quake, where, as you'll recall, I was at a UW men's basketball game that day against, I want to say, Oregon State.
And you were just cruising in, listening to the CD of Night Ripper?
No, it was hanging out with people beforehand, watching the start of
Just a group of millennials hanging out, listening to girl talk?
Yeah, obviously.
Hell yeah, you were. Yeah. You're just like, you want to throw in some millennial jams? And they're like, we've got them all right here.
First off, who would I be hanging out with that was not a millennial?
I know.
In 2010, besides mom.
It's like basically like three records of now.
Everyone
that's what I
knew
call millennial.
Was a millennial.
Right?
It was like, what if we made the whole plane out of millennials?
Yeah. It is. I'm telling you, like, they had him headline Capitol Block Party last year, and I was like, for who, for what? Like, that is everybody who was going
Nostalgia.
Has aged out of it. And I don't think it worked. But I was telling the children, I was like, craziest Capitol Block Party moment I will ever recall is Capitol Block Party 2007, being in Numo's, and it was probably the hottest I've ever been, and a little terrified for my life being inside of there because of how many people were in there. We've talked about that on the podcast, but like, that was a crazy moment. And again, if I'm like, hey, one of the craziest show moments I've ever been to is at a girl talk show, people would be like, what are you talking? Who is this person? And they were like, was that a band? And I'm like, no, it's a white guy from Pittsburgh. Obviously.
I feel like one of my favorite block party memories was sitting in VIP and hearing the opening sounds of Jamie XX wafting out. That was much later, obviously, but ties back to 2012 with the XX album.
Yeah.
So it all comes back to 2012.
Are these all on Spotify? I didn't even think they were on Spotify. I thought these were like iPod only records.
Girl talk?
Yeah, they cleared all this stuff enough to be on Spotify. I'm kind of impressed. Or maybe people just kind of like, it seems like All Day didn't make it for some reason. But yeah, mashup culture. I will say, part of the reason that we'll talk about this in about a month, right? When we talk about the year in music, that rap music is dead, is why it's bad that rap music is dead, is because other artists can't sample rap music. In the same way, if rap music wasn't dead, we would have some sort of version of mashup culture. There would be something with electronic music and rap music, or pop music and rap music at the same time. And it just does not exist. It is like fully quarantined. It is like fully in its space now.
It's
except
so dead.
For that one TikTok trend from with a song from 2012.
It's so dead that you attended a sold-out concert at Lumen Field with Kendrick Lamar in 2025, not in 2012.
I mean,
not a
rock,
thing that could have happened.
Rock music is dead also, and has been, but Foo Fighters were still selling tickets.
Okay,
you know what I mean?
Fine.
Like,
I
that is,
that's
not
same.
A... If you look at, like, the people who, obviously, Camp Flogna was canceled over the weekend, rescheduled over the weekend, and you look at the people who are, like, selling tickets at it, a lot of them, their genesis you could trace back to what is now 13 years ago. Of those people that I mentioned, like two of the headliners, Gambino is, he does have a song. Put it in my video. Do you know that this is apparently a TikTok trend now?
No. How would I know that?
Not on Spotify, that one. But Gambino's like even pre-2012. Right? ASAP Rocky, Goldie is 2012. Tyler, the Creator, Oldie is 2012. And all of his stuff is earlier. Like, these are not new artists.
No.
And even the rest of the artists, it's like, you know, Clips, 2 Chainz. Like, the amount of young rap artists who are on the festival, it's kind of like Tizo Touchdown. People like that. People who are in Tyler's world. Like, it's almost more telling. I mean, Dochi is the only one, basically. So, I don't think you could say that there was, just because there's one sold-out concert, that one sold-out tour, that it makes up for an entire, like, culture being shoved to the side. But all that really matters is being a millennial and listening to girl talk and having a great time.
Love to be a millennial.
Thanks for listening. Are you aware of geese?
Like the animals?
Oh my God. I'm just going to tell you right now in advance. It's not necessarily something that I care about, but I'm going to tell you in advance of our year in music you should probably go listen to the Geese record.
Okay.
They are the most important rock band in the entire world at this very moment.
Oh, wow.
And even like by being the most important rock band in the world in this moment in 2025 means that they are a very important band beyond like what that would have meant maybe 5 years ago.
I suppose so.
You suppose so? Geese is a deal on a big level.
Guess it can't be that big of a level.
Because you're not aware of them?
Yeah. I'm a worldly person.
Maybe you're a little bit too caught up in the girl talk of it all, aren't you?
I mean, I've been listening to a lot of new music in preparation for my top 10 songs of 2025.
How did you not get to this? Literally, what happened that you didn't get to this record?
I don't know. Maybe my algorithm's off.
I truly do not know. Are you listening on Spotify?
Yeah.
I truly do not know how you could be on Spotify and not have had this band force-fed to you. Are you aware of an artist named Cameron Winter?
Know the name.
Well, that is the lead singer of Geese.
Okay.
Who also had a very big year.
All right. Well, we'll report back at the music pod.
Thanks for listening again.
Still, thanks for listening.